Hello, everyone. Welcome to the panel exploring crypto sovereignty. When I heard I was going to do this panel, that I got to moderate this panel, I got really excited because we have in our company three very early Bitcoin adopters from North America. We have Jameson Lopp, co-founder of Casa. He's a prolific cypherpunk writer and researcher, and he's also the editor of a web page that you can find at bitcoin.page, and I always recommend it to people because it has links to so many great resources. We also have Bruce Fenton, who's managing director of Chainstone Labs. He's founder of an annual gathering called the Satoshi Roundtable with some of the smartest Bitcoin entrepreneurs. He's been doing it since 2014. I was lucky enough to attend some of the early meetings. He's also a licensed broker-dealer. And then we have Eric Casson, who's a very early employee at Coinbase, and he also worked at Unchained from Texas, and he's author of the book Crypto Sovereignty, which you can buy here at the conference. I don't know if you're still signing books.
Yeah, I got four left. So.
All right. Well, it's been great. So yeah, just to kick off this panel, I thought I would ask our panelists, you know, what is crypto sovereignty, and what does it mean to you personally? The way I understand it is that crypto means I keep a secret, and then sovereignty means something like the authority of a person to govern themselves. And so how do those two link together for you? And yeah, what does crypto sovereignty mean? Jameson?
Well, you know, I think one of the amazing things that we've managed to build with the Bitcoin protocol is the ability to invert governance. Really, instead of creating a top-down, hierarchical, controlled organization, we have now created this organic, bottom-up, you know, emergent consensus, whereby any of us who care to do so can participate in the governance of Bitcoin, the network, and the protocol by running the software, by validating the ledger, by enforcing the rules to which we agree. And, you know, rather than democracy or voting or some other way of trying to decide that a majority or a certain percentage gets to overrule the rest of the others when it comes to governing the system and deciding the rules, this is crypto anarchy. And essentially, we are each sovereign unto ourselves, but there's an interesting dichotomy that we'll get into with regard to the rest of the ecosystem and, you know, how we connect to each other and create this thing that we call Bitcoin.
Bruce?
Wow, that's a hard answer to top. That pretty much covers it. You know, I think the importance of what you said privacy, crypto is privacy, and the Cypherpunk Manifesto, which I think everybody should read often. It's only like a page and a half. It's short, and it's you know, word for word, it's probably one of the more influential pieces of writing out there. And it mentions privacy more than anything. And I think that there's a big connection that a lot of people in the regular world don't see between privacy and control. You know, because if you have the ability, I see them as kind of linked, and they're very linked in crypto. If you have control of your own private keys, you have control of your own financial sovereignty. And I think that the, you know, privacy is so you know, washed away in today's world with banking regulations and AML, KYC and all of these kind of things that we really just don't need, that don't make a lot of sense. And I think that it can't be underestimated, how key that is to the to each individual sovereignty.
Yeah, like the flip side of like, oh, but if you have nothing to hide, you shouldn't be afraid is we can take from you whatever we want, whenever we want to. So yeah, there is a scary counterpart that a lot of people, I think, don't recognize. Eric, your book is called Crypto Sovereignty. So maybe I'm putting a lot of pressure on you right now, but what does it mean to you?
Well, I chose the word specifically because there's more than one meaning to it. And so as Jameson said earlier, that it's really this understanding that we can invert the systems of power and that we can use cryptography in order to power a totally new sort of system that we're actually building with Bitcoin. But even more importantly, sort of hidden in the idea of sovereignty in itself, as you start to explore what cryptography is and the opportunities that cryptography can provide, you actually found that there's a type of individual sovereignty that can give you deep empowerment against a world that does want to know everything about you, does want to see everything, and if you are, quote, hiding something. And it's very important to understand that this new radical world that we live in, where we're being surveilled almost at every single point in our lives, we do have a methodology that we can actually counter that, and we're slowly starting to build that together. And as we build that to become bigger and bigger, it's not only going to create, in my opinion, a new sort of form of organization for the world order, but we're also going to find much deeper personal sovereignty in terms of what we choose to expose to the world or keep private for our own reasons.
Right. Yeah, you put it really well in your book, I think, where you say, Bitcoin offers a messianic promise in our nihilistic world, and that is the promise that yours is yours, and that it is secured by the truth of cryptography and the promise it must always contain. I really like that. So I wanted to ask to all you, because Jameson, you mentioned to me when I was like asking you, like, what are some of the cypherpunk's writings that inspired you? You said, like, yeah, well, there's a lot there, obviously, but we also have to think about how to extend these ideas into the future. And so I want to ask to all you, like, what are some of these values, of course, you know, privacy being one of them, but maybe others too, that you share with the cypherpunks, and how would you like to see these extended? Like, where do you feel like things need to go for us to, you know, defend sovereignty in this modern digital world? Jameson?
I mean, a lot of it comes down to property rights, but I think that's one of the reasons that Bitcoin works so well, is that we can generally agree that, you know, he who owns the keys controls the coins. You know, it can get a lot more technical and nuanced than that. But, you know, due to the game theory and really the fact that so many people are enforcing the fundamental rule around that, it's not completely impossible, but highly implausible that, you know, the rest of the system, the, you know, Bitcoin society, as it were, is not going to turn on you and, you know, revoke those property rights from you, because it's not in their best wishes to do so, because they know that that could then happen to them. So, you know, I really like the meme. I think Michael Goldstein used the, was it Reservoir Dogs, where, like, Mexican standoff, everybody's watching everybody, everybody's pointing a gun at everybody else, and we're actually all safer as a result.
Yeah, and the cool thing is, like, we don't need to be friends, right? We just have to kind of, you do you, me do me, and just respect that basic idea. Of, like, yeah, we can agree to disagree. Bruce, what's your take on where things need to go?
Yeah, I think we need to push exactly that mindset. You know, it has to be a mindset shift, because the tyrants out there don't have this mindset, and they control the media, and they push these very damaging and harmful ideas on the people. You know, Augustin Carstens, who's the sort of king of the central banks, he's the banker of the bankers, and he had a quote a while ago. He said, you know, in favor of CBDCs, he says, we don't know where a $100 bill goes right now. And my reaction is, dude, why should you know? It's none of your business. It's none of your business what I do with my $100. And from all of economic history, right here in this city, hundreds of years ago, you could walk right down the street and you could buy stocks with gold, the very first stock that was ever created, and they didn't have these kind of rules. And it's not their business. And the idea that it is just deeply fundamentally broken. So we need a mind shift for individuals to realize that this is a human right. Privacy is a human right. You have a right to, you earned your money, you have a right to do whatever you want with it, and it's not government's business at all. We don't need any AML, any KYC, any visibility whatsoever at all. We must push against that and completely reject it.
Hear, hear. Eric.
I'd actually take a dark take on what you just said, and I'd say it absolutely is their business, and their entire business is knowing and seeing what you're doing to
and
steal from
business.
You, and to make reasons to steal from you. And one of the things that really blew my mind when I started exploring this was I realized that what Bitcoin's offering, it's not saying, hey, if you secure your private keys, we will give you access to networks, that we have to. And that there is a strong demarcation line of, it's not that I can't, it's not that I want to steal your Bitcoin and I could, it's that I fundamentally can't. And to me, that, particularly in our world of modernity, like, this actually becomes something that changes our relationships to humans now, because particularly with the conflicts that are going on in the world today, I can send Bitcoin directly to anybody immediately right now in whatever need they have, so long as they can get an internet connection somewhere. And particularly if people are fleeing from endemic violence, war, and other things that are occurring in the world today, like, this becomes a rescuing object that can actually give them a lifeline to get out of these conflicts and situations. And just to relate back to your earlier point, to me, one of the most important cypherpunk documents is the Declaration of Independence of Cyberspace. And to me, like, this specifically is a document that reserves for us saying, hey, this is a tool that we built for you. It provides new powers and sovereignty. And furthermore, your government doesn't understand it and wants to control it because it terrifies them, because they know and understand that this radically challenges their power in a way that they've never faced in all of human history. And I think as people that are now existing within this world where they do want to see everything, they want to make literal exploitation part of their business model, we have to stand up and fight back and say, not only do we not want to do this, it is both illegal and unconstitutional, and we refuse to comply with these idiotic orders that are destroying, frankly, society on a whole today.
So I'm imagining someone listening to this who says, this sounds great and I'm excited to hear it, but I'm working 10, 11 hours a day, I'm struggling. What's in it for me and my family if we can talk about the specifics later, like become a node in this network or kind of contribute to these cypherpunk values? Ultimately, what's in it for me and my family and my community?
Yeah, I mean, it's network effects. The more people who join, the stronger the network becomes. I think a big part of the reason why these systems work, and this is a cypherpunk value, is that we understand that code that is widely dispersed, software that is running on tens or hundreds of thousands of machines all around the world in many different jurisdictions, cannot be shut down. There is, at least as of today, no one world government, and we can use that to our advantage. We also should understand that while governments can portray themselves as having massive amounts of power, and they certainly do in certain cases, the people are far more powerful than the government. The problem that I believe society has had for pretty much all of human history and organization is that it has been collectively very difficult for the individuals to come together and to fight against a government that is actually much weaker than the individuals in aggregate. But the great thing about cryptography, about writing these new protocols, is that they enable a new level of communication and coordination amongst people all over the world, regardless of what language we speak. We are essentially saying we are now speaking this one common language, and it doesn't matter if the government wants to stop us. They cannot silence us because we're using math, and you can't fight math.
And so is what you're saying also that there's two sides to the same coin where, taking back this power, the flip side of that is at the same time you're just taking back your own property, like you become a master of your own future more? Is that also what you're saying?
Yeah, and I mean, I'm even seeing this as, we are creating new opt-in voluntary societies. Mm. It's an amazing thing because I often think of cyberspace versus meat space. And meat space, governments have this monopoly of violence and power, but only within their specific meat space jurisdiction. We are operating in cyberspace, and we reject the meat space powers. They can try as much as they want, to control our physical bodies, but they can't control how we communicate and coordinate with each other.
Hear, hear. Well said. Bruce.
Yeah, I mean, it's like Jameson said, the mass of people should have the power and do have the power and have more power than the tyrants who currently exercise power over us. And the more people that participate running nodes and things, even if you feel like you don't need to, the more people that participate, the more it becomes a thing. It's like the bicycles here in Amsterdam. It's really cool to see people commuting hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of bicycles outside my hotel in the morning, and you see them all over the streets, locked up. And that's not practical in like San Francisco. Your bike would get stolen and they don't have the trails and things like that. But once you have a critical mass, you change society for the better. And I think everybody would agree that all these bicycles are better than not having the bicycles. But why don't other cities have it? You need that critical mass. And it's the same with money. We need to opt out of this tyrant money, the broken, filthy fiat, and have a money that we control. And that it causes all kinds of additional benefits to society. Almost any problem you can think of somehow relates to the printing of fiat. And almost everything good you can think of in the world comes from voluntary interaction. So everybody participating in the network, we're just moving towards, as simple and corny as it sounds, the reason is it makes it a better world.
It's so interesting you bring up the example of the bicycles, because if I remember right, the critical mass of adoption in the Netherlands as far as bicycle adoption was achieved during the occupation in the wartime when there was a huge crisis and there were very little means available, and so people went back to the basics. And so maybe that's a little foretelling of how Bitcoin is going to be widely adopted.
Yeah.
Eric?
Yeah, on that same point, so I think it's really important to understand that one of the primary mechanisms where our government is very powerful is through their methods and modes of propaganda. And that's been one of the things that have very much had people maintain this division between we're national identities, that our politics are right-left, that we have to fight each other for control. And I don't believe that's true at all. I think it's much more of a split this way. I think all people everywhere have much more to gain with working with each other, and the recognition that the tyranny of the United States government is much similar to the tyranny of, say, the European banking system, in that they both have fundamental exploitatory visions to steal from their citizens under the guise of saying, hey, this is for good stuff. And for me, one of the primary reasons I got into Bitcoin was I'm an anti-war activist, and I felt very angry that my money was taken from me to go make war against people that I had never met before. And now with Bitcoin, if I choose to put my wealth into Bitcoin, there is at least a module of general resistance that I can have towards that. And on the critical mass note, as more and more people start to understand, hey, Bitcoin can really help us in these terms and circumstances, and very similar to the war note, that like with inflation being endemic, a lot of people need to escape from this. My hope is as they escape, they'll start to use Bitcoin and they'll go, hey, it turns out that this is actually a much better money. And moving forward, we'll actually start to design more and more systems to be valuable to other people so that they can choose to opt out, and that we can choose to build the circular economies together that will allow for us to have a much more successful and robust society where our values are much closely aligned with each other than rather with our governments.
Yeah, that actually leads me into my next question. 75 years ago, this place where we sit was occupied territory during the Second World War. And so I was wondering, like, what are your thoughts on, God forbid, of course, but if another war broke out in Western Europe, some of these technological tools that we're talking about, some of these networks, would it make things differently today? Like, if that broke out, like, would it give people different tools, different options? What are your thoughts?
Well, it's far more difficult to control the flow of information these days. You know, information wants to be free. You can, of course, go the China route and try to have a great firewall, but even that is not going to be 100% perfect at stopping everything that they want to control. The amazing thing about the internet and even about Bitcoin, in order now to economically interact with people, we only need to be able to send, a kilobyte of data somehow. And while most people who are using Bitcoin are doing that through the internet, that is by no means the only option. We have people who have transmitted Bitcoin transactions, via radio waves and basically pinged them off the ionosphere, sent them, to someone thousands of miles away. This is the level of freedom that this communication enables for us. Like, there is no government or physical power in the world that can, block the exchange of data at that scale.
Mm. So you're saying basically like propaganda would be less efficient and also people would be able to hold on to their savings more?
There will definitely still be propaganda, and you know that's a whole other issue. But you know, if you want to call it the truth, or you want to call it you know the free exchange of ideas and interaction, that is something that is much more difficult for governments to control with today's technology.
Got it, Bruce?
Yeah, I mean all the tools are great and can definitely help a lot. The key is in times of war, tragically, you know, people are totally focused on their own survival and it's a hard time to adapt, you know, new tools. You have to make it easier, which is all the more reason we need to build now. You know, you don't want to be teaching somebody in a war zone, hey, here's this new thing. It's called internet money and blah, blah, blah. You want them to already know how to use it and everything. So I think it's key to, you know, move fast so that we can keep ahead of this. And hopefully, you know, if there is crisis and there is crises in the world, hopefully people will look to this technology.
Yeah, I mean, if we go back to 1913 in Sarajevo and you're like, hey, this place is about to go down real bad, most people will be like, I just don't see it that way. Life's pretty good, trade's high, I can't foresee that. Year later, you know, the full-on World War I is happening, and I think it's very important to understand that such circumstances are starting to threaten Western Europe to this day, and I think it's very important that not only do you teach yourself the mechanics of how Bitcoin works right now, but also other technologies like PGP technology, because like if you have a government surveilling you who wants to stop you, it's very important that you can have end-to-end encryption and know through the protocols directly that those things can offer protection. And then furthermore, there becomes a much greater ability for you to then transact in, you know, what would be black markets under these conditions. Like if you can't buy fuel anywhere and you need to flee the country in your vehicle, well, hopefully you'll have some Bitcoin on you and you'll say, look, I'm more than happy to pay you 10 euros a liter to get a little bit of gas here so I can get out. But to me, it's very important that, like, if you're in the conditions of war, it's not the time for you to start learning these new tools, because you need to be the anchor for your community that understands this. So when this crisis does happen, you can help everyone that you can. And I think it's very important that everybody in the audience here understands, like, you're part of the individuals that understand the importance of this technology, and you need to give this to your community, not because of number go up, but so that government cannot imprison you when that's what they want to do.
Yeah, and in the practical sense, like since the Ukraine invasion, like we've all read direct stories of Bitcoiners in Ukraine who used Bitcoin to get out or like look after their families. Like this is very real. Like this is real technology.
Well, and we've seen multiple examples of the traditional financial system, those rails being cut.
Yeah,
you know that is one of the first things that gets taken down. Is in war, you know, you want to cut off the access of your enemies to as much resources as possible. But we still see, you know, people being able to donate Bitcoin and to use cryptography to basically bypass those restrictions.
Yep. We have 3 minutes left, so just some rapid-fire questions. Jameson, imagine you have a million people around Europe who want to know, you know, what they can do specifically. They have 4 hours available for you every year, and they're going to do whatever you tell them to do to you know, become a node in the network. What would you tell them to do? And their budget is $500.
$500, buy a cheap laptop for probably $150-$200. That'll be your best bang for your performance. To be able to actually run the software, and then of course go to bitcoin.page and just go to the running a node page, and you'll get all of the instructions you need to, you know, in a matter of clicks.
It's all there. Awesome. Bruce, somebody, a European, comes to you and wants to participate in an election campaign on a Bitcoin ticket. He's in the elevator with you. You have 30 seconds. What are your recommendations to them?
Well, you know, I ran for Senate in the U.S. last year. I didn't mention Bitcoin too much. Bitcoin has a mixed brand among the general public. A lot of people are still, you know, 10 years behind on it. So I spoke mostly about money first and the problems with the broken money system. And then, you know, what I said at the, you know, when I was at this same conference in Miami right after I announced that I was running, I said, if you really want to help, don't be a politician or donate to the politicians. take your $5 or $10 or $50 and buy more Bitcoin, because opting out is the best way to starve the beast and starve the tyrants.
Awesome. Eric, last minute here. What is, I mean, you just written a book, but still, what is another book you would like someone to write in the sphere of cypherpunk thinking, or what's a college course that you would love to see someone teach?
Bigger than a college course, I would actually love to see sort of a Bitcoin-focused university that's going to have all of the cross-disciplinary education going on, from art to literature to cryptography, computer science to sociology and philosophy, and then get to kind of have all the cross-disciplinary pollination happen there, because I truly think that it is the exchange of ideas, not just in our fields of interest, but across the way, that will sort of get the most fruitful pollination and really start producing some really wild and interesting content that'll help shift and push the culture forward in a way that I think would be very important and powerful. So that's something that I would love to see.
Eric, Bruce, Jameson, I thought this was riveting. Please give it up for our panelists.
Welcome back to the Bitcoin Amsterdam live desk, brought to you by Bitcoin Magazine. I am with Charlene Fedorepo and Prof. Saint-Onge. We're coming out of the crypto sovereignty panel. We heard from Turdemeester, Jameson Lott, Bruce Fenton, and Alex all about crypto sovereignty. And we heard things that people are talking about all around us, but really in dramatic terms. There it is. We're talking about World War III, right? We're talking about a recalibration of hierarchy. We're talking about top-down versus bottom-up. And it's refreshing, I guess, to get it out there and hear about it in the real world like that. What I heard, though, was the really interesting story about people actually taking the power of cryptography in their own hands. Now, if you go back to World War II, what we saw was, at the end of World War II, of course, when we saw what the code-breaking Turing machine could do, we saw that it was capable of breaking the cryptography from the Nazis, right? And remember, everything that we knew about cryptography before World War II was for war, right? It was a war tool. It was created by governments to participate in war. As I understand, the only civilian invention in cryptography had been like 500 years earlier in Medici, Florence or something like that, right? So the history of it was as a war tool. And unbelievably, after World War II, it was counted as a munition. It was made illegal because it was like developing guns. And suddenly, when I hear the powers that Bitcoin has actually conferred on individuals by giving individuals the power to manipulate the cryptographic protocols and the tools, talking about sending sats against the ionosphere, it sounded like wizards. It sounded like we finally have the power of magic to fight back against tyrants and other stuff. So Charlene, I mean, that's what it came through to me, but hearing the positive voice about the power that we can use to win World War III at this time was really comforting.
We're really talking about that individual responsibility that we all have. You know, you might be the only one in your family that understands Bitcoin. You might be the only one in your community. You have a moral responsibility to share that knowledge so that everyone can benefit and be protected from whatever may come, right? We don't know what is coming, but we do know that we're safer when we have sound money. And the other, can I just make one other point?
Sure.
That something that Bruce Fenton said that really struck me, he said that privacy is a human right. And for me, he's absolutely right. He said that we need a mindset shift in this country. We have been trained by all of these apps to give away our personal data. I worry about our children. You know, our children are so used to sharing data, sharing information, and we are not teaching ourselves to protect our data. And our data is one of the most important things that we have about ourselves. And I think that Bruce is right, there is a mindset shift that is necessary for all of us to just, hold what we have close. Because it is very valuable to companies, and it is absolutely valuable to governments.
Seeing people trade it so easily, though, indeed, right? We see people give it away for a little bit of eye candy on the internet. It doesn't take much, right? And but that's not, to me, that's not the only thing Bitcoin offers in this debate, right? Indeed, we might have our own individual privacy, our own individual protection. I think that's all important. That's the side of the story they covered really well on that. Mm-hmm. But I think there's another advantage here in that we can actually turn transparency backwards. Mm-hmm. You know, one of the things we don't actually have is the reverse. We don't know what's going on with governments because of dark money, because of fiat. There is no feedback loop. I've often said that's why you ended up listening from unhealthy people during COVID telling you about how to be healthy. That's a sign of a system that has no feedback mechanism, that isn't actually dealing with its problems and getting the sort of A-B testing you need. And I think, you know, just looking at public balance sheets and things like that, one of the most mischievous things that fiat has managed to do is exactly that. It seems like people have this easy answer, just like they'll give away their personal data. They say, well, the government will fix it. They'll fix it. They'll get more money. Right.
Yeah, governments in a lot of ways, I think, have been sort of coasting on the goodwill that most people will say they earned it during the first part of the century. I think it was more they censored it during the first part of the century. So before we had the internet, you know, people talk about the golden age when everybody agreed with each other. And well, okay, but they agreed with each other on the regime line, right?
Yeah.
No other opinion was really allowed to flourish. And you know, I think during that period, governments have really weaponized a lot of these texts. They've weaponized crypto, as you said, right? So that, you know, thousands of years ago, crypto as a concept was a children's game. It was then applied in commercial transactions, you know, so your competitors don't know what you're doing. Government, of course, homesteaded that. Government homesteaded the big one, which was money. So they turned money into a weapon of war. When the Federal Reserve was founded, within 1 year, the entire world was shooting at each other, funded by the Federal Reserve. During the Second World War, the German regime they literally airdropped money onto the British countryside. Okay, you can still buy these online. They dropped all this money because they wanted to spark hyperinflation. So think about that for a sec, right? That is what central banks do today. Mm-hmm. In fact, they don't even do that, right? The Fed does not send helicopters out to drop the money down. It does even worse. It actually, you know, funnels them through asset markets so that it makes the rich richer. But the point here is that the Germans were dropping money to destroy the economy, and the Fed does even worse by not only destroying the economy but making the rich rich. I mean, money has been absolutely weaponized. And so there's this sort of swords to plowshares aspect of Bitcoin where it takes all of these technologies that have been perverted, that have been turned into these evil things, and it turns them around. It turns them against the state, right? Every person who gets in the lifeboat of Bitcoin drains the swamp, right? It pulls out the seniorage that the state can print over and can seize assets from. So really, I think we are turning their own weapons against us, just as they turned our inventions against us.
When I think about the actual fault line now in what World War III is looking like, you know, we've seen it in America, right? We've seen it divided by race. We've seen it in the Middle East now divided by race. We've seen propagandists talking about China all the time and Russia. You know, I've never seen Bitcoin do better than when I see your average Chinese person, your average Russian person, your average American all realizing, hey, there's something in this for us, right? And, you know, take America, for example, right? Really, the dichotomy in America is rich and poor, and it always has been, right? It's been rich and poor for a long time. And now we have all this trouble that seems to be coming out of nowhere, right? And now we're dealing with an existential crisis that's being created by we don't even know what. Whoever's funding the people that are saying this stuff, that are spreading this information around, right? And it doesn't seem like we're even aware of what's happening, or at least a lot of people. I think that one of the things we can do in our own communities is exactly that, is say, like, look, the fight here is really different than what you're being told it is, right? And so does what I'm saying make sense?
It does. The question is, where is the fight? Where do you want to put your energy? Where can your energy be most well spent and have the most impact in your community? And I think the fight is sharing Bitcoin with your community so folks can either build a business so that they can build generational wealth for themselves, so that they can understand the world that is coming, so that they can retool and be a productive citizen in their society. You know, that's where we should focus our attention. You know, that's how we, you know, improve the quality of life for everybody. And when the average quality of life improves, there's a little less to argue about. Honestly, it's the wealth gap that we have in the United States is significant. It is similar to the wealth gap that we have around the world. But I think money doesn't solve everything. However, when you create opportunities for people, then they can actually be more productive in the world.
And that reminds me of what they were discussing in these opt-in societies. You know, the idea that we are now able to choose new rules by which we can engage with governments or even with each other, right? The P2P market, the P2P electronic cash network seems to extend to things far beyond just an electronic cash network. I see it in media. I see Bitcoiners that are able to use the P2P network to filter out fake news, right? I've seen health outcomes for Bitcoiners increase as they share bro science, I guess they call it, and the carnivore stuff and the diet, you know. These opt-in societies seem to be focused not so much on number go up, but indeed already what they're talking about, health and wealth. And what they talked about, the victim of World War III, they described it as someone who is sort of working a 10 to 11 hour job and doesn't really even have the time frame or the attention span to focus on the, you know, we're talking about magic here, but the magic trick of fiat money, right? They're not able to even see it.
Yeah, and a lot of those people, they're sort of distracted by politics, the opiate of the masses, you know, so they try to set us against each other. To, you know, divide and conquer so they can, you know, keep on printing, they can keep on doing sweetheart deals, passing each other these trillion-dollar thefts. And I think what's exciting, in a sense, it has been getting, I think, a lot worse fast since COVID came in, that was really their opportunity, and they learned a lot, and they're going to do it again over and over. But at the same time, from that, it has been so extreme that people are waking up by the million. I mean, you're seeing it all over, that people just reject the elite narrative. And what's beautiful is that's happening on left and right, right? This is not a partisan thing. You get, you know, former Bernie bros, you get people on the hard left who, they come to Bitcoin, it wakes them up, they see that the fight, it's not between us. And, you know, this has been a 100-year theme, right? During World War I, the ruling elite was constantly saying, no, this is a nationalism thing. This is, you know, this is the French working class against the German working class. And honestly, it was the socialists who said, no, that's not what this is. This isn't a fight between we the people. So it's exciting for me that I think Bitcoin brings people from, you've got anarcho-capitalists, which is kind of, you know, the home culture of Bitcoin, but then you've got people coming in from all over the place who are really getting their eyes opened.
I mean, I think that the whole Bitcoin community promotes a free exchange of ideas. And actually, it's kind of good to be around people that are different, because then you can either learn to defend your idea or maybe open your mind to something new, right? We cannot afford to stay in our little bubbles. And I think that's the beauty of the Bitcoin community. We are bringing people together. We don't always agree. That's okay. You know, we can learn from each other and we can grow together.
And, you know, when I see the power of cryptography come down to the individual, and we're talking in terms of magic almost being imbibed in an individual, one of the things that I've realized, and you saw it when we had the elections in the United States in 2020, right?
Yep.
You know, Bitcoiners through the scaling debates had understood for a while, when we're talking about cryptographic systems, just the knowledge that came from studying it, there's trade-offs, right? You can be convenient, or you can be credible, right? We saw Ethereum, for example, choose convenience. Hey, we got to make it easier, faster, it's not fast enough, right? And then Bitcoin, of course, chose credibility. Mm-hmm. Now, I don't know anything. I have no reason to doubt anything happened, and everything in all 50 states was run exactly perfectly, right? Everything was perfect. But Bitcoiners have understood for a long time that you don't get to choose both. There is no option where a thing is both convenient and credible. And so that's another one of those frames that Bitcoiners went, well, you made it easier. Do I have to believe this now because it's easy? And that's what I see as these, like you said, you went out of your bubble. We all went out of our bubble. I didn't know anything about cryptography. We were laughing off camera. I had a law degree and I worked for the Senate Banking Committee, and I was an absolute illiterate financially until Bitcoin. Illiterate, you know, law degree, didn't know what I was talking about. It's the same with cryptography. By having that stuff come into your life, you're able to understand these questions and start making those, you know, cost-benefit analysis, just basic stuff, right?
Yeah. Yeah, people are really learning how to run their lives in a way that they had never certainly learned through formal education. And, you know, it's good that we learn now, because the only alternative is to learn it through experience, like to get your life savings wiped out. So it's good for people to be prepared.
Well, the funny news about all this and the ironic news is that we're going to go have a political debate now. So we'll catch you after this. Thanks a lot. And we'll see you in a few more minutes for another session of Bitcoin Amsterdam Live.
Thank you, Miami, for the last 3 years in this amazing city. The whole world shut down, but Miami welcomed us with open arms. We want to show Bitcoin to the whole world. We are taking the conference on the road to set the stage for Bitcoin in a new city. Nashville. Bitcoin 2024 is coming to Nashville in Tennessee, a city that is known as a music and freedom city. Bitcoin 2024 in Nashville from July 25th to 27th.